Hello and welcome to the 50th episode of the Loopcast. Today I'm very happy to have Zach Gold on the line, and we are going to be here discussing some of the recent events in Egypt. As everyone knows, even before June 30th, but let's just say since June 30th, things have really blown up over there. So this is an exciting talk because every day things are changing in Egypt. And on top of this, we really want to also talk about the Egyptian Sinai. And Zach recently came back from Egypt and the Sinai. So it will be really, really interesting to hear his thoughts on how things were on the forefront over there. So thank you for coming on the show, Zach.
Oh, no problem, Chelsea. Thank you so much for having me. You and Sina, I'm looking forward to this conversation. I should off the bat note that I wasn't recently in Sinai. I had considered going to conduct some research, and let's say it's not the best time.
Exactly. That's true. Okay. I misunderstood. I know you were in Egypt. But
that's right. During my time in Egypt and Israel as well, I was actually conducting a lot of research about Sinai policy. And those policies, of course, are made in the capitals. So while it would have been interesting, certainly, to go to the front lines, I felt it better for my livelihood at the time to not do so. But let's just jump into it and talk about Egypt now, because you said that Egypt every day is different. I would argue that Egypt every few minutes is different.
Very true. It's just like you have to keep up on it. Personally, it seems like you have to be logged onto the internet 24 hours a day, whether it's Twitter, news feeds, almost everything, because it just is changing, like you said, every minute.
And it's absolutely maddening, because those of us who follow Egypt closely do try to some extent to stay focused. But I find, for example, that if I'm just writing about the current events, by the time I've drafted an outline, those events have completely changed. And so it's one of those situations where you need to try to always look at the broader picture. So I hope today we do go into the details of what's happening at the moment, what happened earlier today, because I think these things will be very influential for the future of Egypt. But I don't want to dwell specifically on details, because by the time your listeners hear it, they'll be on and saying, why are they talking about irrelevant things?
Very true. So let's kind of just, I'm going to give you the bat here, and why don't you give us a recap of some of the things that have happened, let's say in the last 12 hours. I mean, you don't need to list everything, because
sure,
as we were saying, it's, yeah.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to discuss is the protests outside of the Republican Guard in Cairo. These were pro-Morsi protesters. They have been holding a sit-in outside the Republican Guard basically since Morsi was overthrown. At the time of the overthrow, it was reported that Morsi was inside the Republican Guard headquarters. It's unclear whether he's still there. He actually hasn't been seen in several days. But there was a Islamist-led, a brotherhood-led sit-in outside of the Republican Guard. Now, this morning, actually, at sunrise, during prayer, there was a confrontation started between the military and the protesters. There have been differing accounts. All of the protesters and many of the journalists on the scene will say that there was an unprovoked attack on the protesters. The military gave a press conference later in the day saying that indeed they had been attacked, that a armed group from within the protesters had tried to storm the building, that a number of soldiers were, that I believe one or two were killed and a number were injured. And so then there was this response. Now, I wasn't there. I can't say exactly how it started, but it was clear that the response was out of proportion. And the lightest figure I saw was about 50 dead out of the protesters. And these were not, again, not necessarily protesters who were being violent. They were just there.
Correct. And I saw the around the same number as well a little bit earlier today. And I mean, I heard that these I guess we could call them like a pro-Morsi coalition almost. I've heard that they have called for another mass protest tomorrow to mourn those killed today.
Yes.
So, I mean, it seems like this is just going to continue and potentially escalate.
In a way, yes. The Brotherhood has been saying that it will not take itself off the streets. It won't call its supporters away from protests until Morsi is reseated as president. So whether or not there's the violent response from the military or elsewhere, it does seem that they're not backing down. Now, where this morning's events complicate things is that the coalition backing the military's move had Islamists in it. It was not simply a secular or non-Islamist opposition movement that sided with the military. There were members such as the Salafi Noor Party, which is the largest Salafi party, and it actually received the second largest block in the now disposed parliament after the Brotherhood. So they are a large constituency, and they sided against the Brotherhood, which is interesting in many ways that we can go into, and I hope we do. But one of the negatives of this morning's actions is that the Noor Party has removed itself from negotiations over a transition. They have called this a red line and called the event a massacre and said that they're not going to work within the transitioning body, which sort of takes all Islamist actors out of that body moving forward. And so where it had been an Egyptian society versus the Brotherhood and a few Brotherhood supporters, Islamist groups that were supporting Morsi, it is now very much a non-Islamist versus Islamist situation.
Right, and I find that very interesting because, I mean, initially the protests really, at least from a personal standpoint, I saw it more of as, you know, the Egyptian people wanting their voice shown, their grievances with Morsi's government, and, you know, the Egyptian army, when there's also the topic of whether we call this a coup or not, but let's say when the Egyptian army took power, I guess that's the best way of describing it. You know, you really at first had this thought of, okay, they're going to be there, they're going to try to keep the peace, and everyone's going to be able to have their say, but, you know, this is for Egypt. It's not just for one side or the other, but as the hours grew when the army took over, it just seemed like it started going towards one side and the other side was not having their voice heard. So in that sense, where do you see this, if you want to call it Islamist versus moderate struggle in Egypt taking the country?
Sure. I guess I have trouble with the terminology moderate. I would simply say non-Islamist, because I think when we say secular, that's wrong, because many of them are certainly practicing Muslims. And when we say liberal, that's also wrong. In fact, you could see that they were willing to overthrow a democratically elected president, which is not, in my mind, liberal. But I think that where we're taking things is to a situation where the Islamist stream... I wrote a lot about the Salafis when they first joined the political process in Egypt, and it was very interesting to see that transition. And I think, as I mentioned, it wasn't, you know, seculars or non-Islamists against Islamists. It was everyone against Morsi. Even the Salafis, or a large segment of the Salafis, were against Morsi and the Brotherhood's authoritarian tendencies. But the Noor Party was still willing to participate in the political process because they had something to gain through the political process. One of the things that I fear and that is a concern to many that I speak with is that the removal of a democratically elected Islamist government sort of feeds this Al-Qaeda-backed narrative that Islamists cannot come to power democratically and that involvement in a democratic process gets them nothing.
Yes, and I've heard that debate a lot, especially today in various forms of the media. It seems like there are certain spokesmen from radical Islamic groups that are basically taking the overthrow of Morsi and a democratically elected president in Egypt and sort of running with that and making this point of, I think it was, I'm trying to think of the country, but there is one group that basically
I know Shabab in Somalia said this
on their social media. Exactly. They said something along the lines of democracy doesn't work. It's only guns and blood or something very dramatic like that.
Right.
And so it really seems like Egypt is hanging in this position of potentially ratifying and trying to try democracy again, or potentially really fueling the fire for extremism around the globe, I guess you could say. I mean, how do you find that? What are your thoughts?
I agree with that. And I think that really a transition in Egypt moving forward without Islamist involvement is not going to succeed. And so I don't support a lot of what Islamists stand for and a lot of their political platforms, but they are a large constituency within Egypt, within the region, and to ignore them is really to ignore democracy itself. And there is certainly an argument to be made about whether they support democracy in the sense that they don't support a lot of liberal policies, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, women's rights that we generally associate with democracy. But at the same time, they have been willing, most of them, to play a role within the political process. And I think that Egypt needs to be very careful, especially given its history of fighting Islamist terrorists at home, about starting that sort of a fight again.
And on that point, I mean, you were mentioning the Noor Party earlier, and bringing that point in of not wanting to shove the Islamist element completely out of the discussion when it comes to Egypt's future. How do you see this interesting development of the Noor Party basically turning, I guess you could say, turning against Morsi?
Sure. Well,
could you discuss that further?
The Noor Party has actually always been against Morsi. There was a brief time after his there was a brief time during the runoff election, so when it was only Morsi versus Ahmed Shafiq, where they did back Morsi, and in the very beginning they backed Morsi. At the same time, that was a point where most of the so-called revolutionary groups also backed Morsi, where he was running against a remnant of the Mubarak regime who basically he campaigned on returning the country to the era of Mubarak. So at that time, the Noor Party did back Morsi. However, in the, let's say, primaries, when there were multiple candidates, they actually chose to back Abdelmanem Abou Fatouh, who is a Brotherhood outcast. He had been a member of the Brotherhood. He had been a leader of the Brotherhood for a long time. And he and they parted ways because he wanted to run for president. And at the time, they didn't want to be running president. So he was booted from the group. And the Noor Party, along with the Gamma Islamia, backed him because as an institutional body, they didn't want to be little brother to the Brotherhood. They wanted to have a candidate who needed them to back. So them turning away from the Brotherhood is not new, and it's also not a coincidence. I'm sure you read Will McCance's piece today in Foreign Affairs. It's not a coincidence that now, again, the Noor Party has taken the opportunity to throw the Brotherhood under the bus to their own political advantage. At the same time, I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs last summer after the Abou Fatouh collapse in the presidential election, saying that the Noor Party can only go so far away from its constituencies. So it will play a very political game in terms of party politics, but it's not going to back away from calling for Sharia law. It's not going to back away from the types of policies that its followers of the Salafi call would support. So when there are Muslims, as they see on TV, being massacred by the army, they can't just sit by and support that, even if it would be to their political advantage, because they would then lose their constituency followers.
And then the other thing that I find interesting is this roundup of a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood members, let's say high-ranking members, when basically the Egyptian army's timeline for Morsi stepping down took place.
Yeah.
And I mean, even though it wasn't on the magnitude of what happened during Nasser's time, it still had a reminiscent feeling of that, where the Brotherhood were basically rounded up and put in prison, which created a lot of extremism from that. And I mean, what are your views on that?
I think I agree with you, and I think that should be a concern, in that if there are Brotherhood members who are calling for violence, then they should be rounded up. If there is evidence that this is taking place, then I do agree in prosecuting them and acting properly. However, I think that, again, I mentioned that members of the Islamist, current, as it would be considered, need to be included in the future of Egypt, and that includes the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood isn't going to go away no matter how hard the government cracks down on them, or the army cracks down on them. So I think that if the army had any hope of involving the Brotherhood in the future, now it seems that from their actions that they do not. But if they had any hope of involving them in the future after Morsi, it doesn't seem likely after such mass arrests. I would say that, you know, prior to the overthrow of Morsi, the army was trying to convince him to be more compromising, that he really needed to work with the other currents of Egyptian society. And I would argue that same thing going forward. Whoever leads Egypt during the transition, whether it's interim president Mansour or a prime minister, and whoever leaves Egypt in the future, is going to need to lead through some sort of consensus. So the army can't simply say Morsi wasn't ruling by consensus, therefore he's gone, and then not rule by consensus after Morsi.
Yes. And then, I mean, I don't know if this is current because this came up still a couple of hours ago, but one of the presidential spokesmen mentioned that a constituent assembly would be formed in the matter of around 2 weeks, and that potentially presidential elections would take place in 6 months. Is this still what you have heard, or has it changed in the last couple of hours?
Well, that's what I heard actually right as we were getting on the phone together. And it was basically that within the next 2 weeks, there'll be a committee that will amend a constitution. Now, I haven't seen the actual text, so I can't say if that's going to be a committee that rewrites an entire constitution, or if they simply are taking the constitution that was passed last winter and making some changes. So that, I don't know, but they'll come up with something in about 5 months from now, or 4.5 months after they're set to work. And that will go to a referendum. And then following that, there will be parliamentary elections. And then following parliamentary elections, there will be presidential elections. Now, this is very interesting, actually, because historically, the Brotherhood has called for a strong parliamentary system, whereas a lot of liberal actors are happier with a strong, or have been happier with a strong presidential system. And this is under the theory that the Brotherhood could mobilize people on constituency basis in individual neighborhoods, and they might be able to gain more seats in a parliament. Therefore, the Brotherhood would want a parliamentary system. Those who are against the Brotherhood will say, well, we could more easily get 50% of the country to vote for someone who's not the Brotherhood en masse than we could work on the ground level. Therefore, we want a strong president who can keep that parliament run by the Brotherhood in check. Now, that was not how the last constitution was written last fall, because at the time it was the Brotherhood who held the presidency. So as soon as they were able to gain the presidency, you saw their idea of parliamentary power versus presidential power completely flip.
Interesting.
And so it'll be interesting now to see if these constitutional changes work to weaken the role of the president, which would make sense in this system to not have one strong figure. However, it is likely that by weakening the president, you would strengthen a Islamist parliament if Islamists are allowed to run as they were the previous time around.
Right. That's very, very interesting. It will be really interesting to see how this all plays out in the next mm-hmm. number of months.
And I think a lot of the considerations are basically reacting to the last problem. And so you might see a constitution that – this is entirely speculation, of course. You might see the next constitution that weakens the role of the president in a way that could end up helping Islamists in the long run.
And then on a little bit of a different note, being an analyst who likes to focus on U.S. and Egyptian relations, mm-hmm. why don't we just briefly, before we get into Sinai, discuss this debate about U.S. aid to Egypt, because mm-hmm. there have been a lot of discussions lately about what should be done, mm-hmm. a lot of opinions. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
give us a little bit of a – yeah, go for
sure,
it.
Sure. So just for background for those listeners who are not as familiar, there is a law in the U.S. standing that basically says – that if a country undergoes a coup or the overthrow of a government by military decree, that U.S. aid is removed from that, is not given to that country anymore. So the aid relationship is halted. Now, again, you mentioned earlier in this broadcast, are we discussing whether or not Egypt had a coup? Now, it seems, given today's press statements by the presidential spokesman as well as the State Department spokeswoman, that America is not defining this as a coup, because if it were to define it as a coup, it would have to end that aid relationship.
Right.
And again, for further background, of course, the U.S. gives the Egyptian military, which is now nominally in charge of Egypt, $1.3 billion a year. So at a time that the Obama administration is trying to leverage the relationship with the now ruling military, it doesn't want to cut off that aid. I think that's a wrong decision personally. First of all, the U.S.-Egyptian relationship does need to change anyway. So it seems that if the Egyptian military is going to give us an excuse to start assessing how that changes, I don't see why that's not something to take advantage of. At the same time, if we were to cut off aid immediately, it would not have that much of an immediate effect, in that Secretary Kerry released a tranche of aid to the military in May, and it's unclear exactly when we would even be sending the next tranche of aid, or rather depositing the next tranche of aid into a bank account. So it's not as if the Egyptian military or the country itself would go bankrupt without this aid. The one thing that cutting off the relationship by calling this a coup would affect is the transfer of F-16s to Egypt. We actually started this year with a deal to transfer 20 F-16s to Egypt. This had been signed in, I believe, 2009 and approved in 2010, and they started coming in January of this year. Four F-16s were flown from America to Egypt. At the time, it created some controversy because obviously this deal was signed prior to the fall of Mubarak, but the idea was that the remainder of those planes would come sometime in 2013. I'm not sure exactly how many are still on delivery. It's certainly more than 10. And so cutting off the aid now would halt those immediately, whereas halting the money would not necessarily stop right away. But I think on the more important, why we should cut aid for various reasons. One, we don't want to encourage coups around the world with other allied militaries. We certainly don't want to encourage the Egyptian military to be interfering in the political process to the extent that every time there's a large enough protest where someone doesn't like the leader, that they step in. And I think that by withholding aid, something that the Egypt Working Group wrote today, by withholding the aid, you pressure the Egyptian military to move quickly on this transition path. Now, if the roadmap, the constitutional declaration that was issued today saying that there are going to be parliamentary elections in 6 months is held, it's quite possible that within 6 months, Egypt wouldn't even need the aid that we would be withholding. But by withholding it, we keep them to that timeline.
Okay. And why don't we move this discussion down to the Egyptian Sinai? Because the Egyptian Sinai is a very interesting and, I guess I could describe it, wild place. It's sort of what I like to call the rogue province of Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I would think many Egyptians would probably consider it as such, too.
It just seems like, especially in the last 2 years, it's been rift with a lot of conflict. Mm-hmm. So I know you do a lot of analysis with the Sinai and the relationship between Sinai, Egypt, and of course Israel, which they mm-hmm. share a border, which always has incidents happening. Mm-hmm. So open up some good statements about the Sinai. I mean, I know, like I said, there's been so much going on in the past 2 years.
Sure.
Lots of militant attacks. I mean, it seems like it's a breeding ground for militancy, for one, which is a huge problem to the security of the whole Egyptian mm-hmm. state. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think my first point on Sinai would be that there are several actors inside the generally sparse peninsula who we would generally think of as conducting terrorist acts. Not all are Salafi jihadis, although they certainly exist there, but I would say that most of the incidents that take place in the Sinai, especially the attacks against the police checkpoints, not all of them, but most of them, are actually conducted by local Bedouin populations, by Bedouin smugglers, and by criminal groups, not necessarily by jihadis. The jihadis are there and they have a lot of their own interests, but I think a lot of the violence that you just mentioned that we've been discussing since the fall of the Mubarak regime has been the Bedouin population exacting revenge on the police and the interior ministry that had during the Mubarak years been both neglecting them and abusing them. So I think that that needs to certainly be thought of. There's certainly as well the Salafi jihadi groups. You may have seen earlier this week, perhaps over the weekend, there's a statement by allegedly a new group, Ansar al-Sharia, out of the mm-hmm. Sinai. Now, this is at least the second, perhaps the third, Ansar Sharia group to claim existence in Egypt. As far as I've seen, this one only exists on the internet, but that doesn't mean that there aren't followers somewhere in the Sinai. They've made some threats against the state, saying that they will act in response to Morsi's being overthrown. And so far, most of these responses that say they're responding to Morsi's overthrow are targeted towards the Egyptian state, towards the police. You've seen, I believe, 7 or maybe 8 or 9 by now Egyptian police officers killed in Sinai in the past few days. Yes. Some of those, again, are regular ongoing attacks. Some of them, however, have been more coordinated and seem to, if not be because of, certainly using as an excuse, the Morsi coup. You also had the Mujahideen Shura Council in the environs of Jerusalem, which claimed to have shot rockets at a lot across the Israeli border in response. To date, the Israelis haven't actually found these rockets. However, there was an explosion heard within the vicinity, so it's possible they shot the rockets and they may or may not have gone over the border. And again, but that group, however, shoots rockets sort of whenever it can. So I don't exactly take for face value that it is shooting rockets in response to events in Egypt.
Correct. And I mean, there's also the the fact that there are the gas pipelines that mm-hmm. go through, originate in Sinai and attach to Jordan, mm-hmm. As well as other parts of the Middle East. And mm-hmm. I think in 2012, the Mujahideen Shura Council, the protectors of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. they've got a long wordy name, but I'm pretty sure they took responsibility for, I think it was like 14 different attacks on the gas pipelines, because that tends to be another hot spot for attacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not in 2012. Certainly in 2011, there were probably more than 10 attacks just in 2011, which actually started before Mubarak was overthrown. And then over the course of 2012, there were a couple more. I believe I just read that the recent attack on that pipeline was the first one in a year.
Right.
So
there was one on Sunday. Is that correct?
Exactly, on Sunday. Yeah. So right now, that pipeline used to send gas to Israel and Jordan. You may know that the trade was cut off between Egypt and Israel over a business dispute, according to the Israeli government. The company that received the gas in Israel claimed that it wasn't receiving enough gas per the contract, and the Egyptian company that was sending the gas claimed that it wasn't receiving any money, and so that relationship just ended for the time being. At the same time, Israel discovered large gas deposits off of its coastline, so it's been a little less concerned about that than it otherwise would have been.
Interesting. And then on this topic of Israel and its relation with Egypt and the Sinai, I know you've written about this.
Yeah.
Give us your views on that and what you've researched.
Sure. So it's really been interesting to talk to Israelis about the situation in Egypt broadly and Sinai more particularly. I think when I first started speaking with experts and with security personnel and leaders, I was expecting there to be a bit of a sky is falling attitude after the loss of Mubarak. And certainly they do miss the close political relationship they had with Mubarak, where during those times, if there was ever any sort of emergency, they knew they could call the president and have things taken care of. At the same time, even though that political channel hasn't existed since the fall of Mubarak, there has been a tightening in many ways of the security coordination. And both Israelis and Americans and Egyptians say that the relationship between the two neighbors has never been so close in terms of security coordination and intelligence cooperation, especially as it relates to the Sinai. So Israel's main concern, of course, is the Sinai being used as a launch point for attacks on its country. Secondary to that is its concern of, maybe on par in some ways, primary to that, is the concern of Sinai being used as a smuggling route of weapons to Gaza. So the Sinai is seen as both a source of weapons for Gaza and also a launching point for especially Gaza-based militants to sort of branch out from Gaza and go into Sinai to create problems for Israel. And we've seen in attacks in August of 2011 and August of 2012 that perpetrators seem to be trying to goad the Israeli forces to fire into Egypt. They were purposefully attacking in a way that would almost guarantee an international incident took place. And we saw that this took place actually in August of 2011. The terrorists were successful in that not only did they infiltrate Israel and kill 8 Israelis, but they were able to goad Israel into crossing the border into Egypt and killing 5 to 7 Egyptian border guards who they mistook for the perpetrators. And this created a whole problem. This was under SCAF rule, but it created a whole problem with various political actors in Egypt calling for an end to the treaty and sending the ambassador out of the country. There was, in September of 2011, a huge protest outside of the Israeli embassy that actually breached the embassy. You might remember Spider-Man, the famous Egyptian protester who climbed the building and tore down the Israeli flag. But then at that night, over the evening of September 9th, in the early hours of September 10th, the embassy itself was breached. And that was a real wake-up call for the Israelis because, as I said, in previous times, if they had issues, they could call Mubarak and things would be taken care of. In this situation, from reports, it really took American cajoling to, at the last minute, get Egyptian special forces into the embassy to save five Israeli security personnel who, who knows what would have happened to them had a mob invaded the embassy. And that, luckily, that tamped down. I think Israel realized the importance of the strategic importance of their relationship with Egypt. You saw very soon after that an apology from the Minister of Defense in Israel, apologizing for the death of soldiers. And this happened at a time, if you recall, that Israel was refusing to apologize to Turkey over deaths. Right. And it had been almost a year later, they had still refused to apologize to Turkey, but they were very quick to apologize to Egypt because one of the things that they have realized is the necessity of the strategic relationship. And something that I've been thinking about is really, as concerned as Israel is with rocket fire from Sinai, which we've seen, every few months there's been one or two rockets from Sinai into Israel. There has yet to be any casualties from this, but it's sort of a matter of time before there is. But it seems to me now that Israel is willing to accept the dripping of rockets if the alternative, if going into Sinai to stop them, will end that strategic relationship. And you see often, of course, there was massively in Lebanon in 2006, but also you've seen situations where Israel has acted in Syria because it's concerned of its security because of weapons transfers going on there. But Israel has really avoided acting on the other side of the Egyptian border because the relationship itself is more important than short-term, annoyances in the security front.
And so with recent events in Egypt, just regarding the Sinai, I know that today there are protests in, I think it was near Rafah and Sheikh Zawaida, between basically Egyptian armed forces and pro-Morsi supporters that got fairly violent because these supporters did have arms.
Right.
And the military basically enforced a full military curfew in this region. So, with this hotbed of emotion already in the capital and the more populated, well, maybe that's not the best way of describing it, but the more modernized, less wild parts of Egypt.
Yeah.
So now you have the Sinai that has been completely wild and woolly for the last number of years.
Right.
I mean, Israel must be quite worried about this situation because yes, they had better relations with Mubarak, but without even Morsi in power now, they sort of have this security vacuum.
Don't see it that way. I think one of the interesting things, because Morsi wanted absolutely nothing to do with Israel, that bilateral relationship was handled entirely by the security forces. And now, of course, the security forces have even more control than they did under Morsi. The security forces, especially generals that I've spoken with, will say that they didn't do any actions in the Sinai without Morsi's authority anyway. But even now that he's gone, they don't have to sort of convince Morsi that going after Islamists is necessary, because he's not there anymore. And I think we've seen reports in the past couple of days that security coordination between Israel and Egypt has been even stronger. I saw reports over today and over the weekend of separate trips of Israeli officials, of Israeli security officials to Egypt to discuss the Sinai. You've seen greater Egyptian troop deployments in the Sinai, and these, of course, because of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, all major deployments need to be approved by Israel, and you've seen them approving that, and you've seen Egypt moving tanks and aircraft in a way that they haven't before, since the lead up to June 30th.
Interesting, yeah, because it did seem like for a while there that you'd get these conflicting reports of Egyptian military presence, and then someone else would say, yeah, it's not as big as they're making it out to be, but you're saying that they're actually sending more troops and having more influence in the Sinai region.
So it's always possible that it's not as big as they're making it out to be. In many ways, the Egyptian army has learned that by making it out to be big, it's had an effect. We saw this in the recent kidnapping of Egyptian police and soldiers, that almost before the Egyptians acted, simply by deploying tanks over the Suez into Sinai, they were able to show their seriousness and got the soldiers and policemen returned. So I think that they're under the impression in many ways that sort of looking tough is the same as being tough. Now, I don't know how long that will hold up. There were reports, the Israeli press said 30, the Egyptian press said 50, of tanks, Egyptian tanks being brought into the Rafah area to guard the Gaza border. Now, if you're looking for infiltrators coming under tunnels, I'm not exactly sure why you would need tanks. But again, it's just a show of force.
And haven't they hasn't the Egyptian army recently staged sort of a crackdown on some of these smuggling tunnels? I remember reading somewhere that they were trying to, I don't know if it was block off or destroy certain tunnels that were being used for arms smuggling.
So following the August 5th, 2012 attack in Sinai, in which 16 soldiers were killed during a breakfast during Ramadan.
Ramadan attacks, as I like to call them, right?
Yes. So following that, Egypt started to crack down on the tunnels to an extent that it had never done. And if you go back and look at the relationship between Egypt and the U.S., in fact, the U.S. was always trying to get Egypt to crack down. It was trying to get Mubarak to crack down on the tunnels in a way that he did not. But following that attack, the Egyptians really saw Gaza as a threat to themselves. And I think the way that we view it here in the U.S. is that the tunnels are a threat to Israel because of weapons that go through the Sinai to Gaza, and then from Gaza they're used to attack Israel. The way that Egypt sees it is that there are highly trained militants inside Gaza with a whole lot of arms that can come out of Gaza and attack Egypt. So they, after that attack, really accepted the threat from Gaza and the need to crack down on those tunnels because of that. This was in many ways complicated and continues to be complicated by the Israeli blockade on Gaza in terms of what types of goods can come in. And we can talk about that too, but it's a bit off topic from this. But anyway, so in August they started, and I was told that I believe it was somewhere around 240 tunnels were covered or destroyed in 2012. Now, this is very misleading because many of those were simply, it's a tunnel. If you go and cover up the hole, the opening, then will go away, then someone can easily redig the opening. So
right.
So I know people who have been out there to see the tunnels who have said that more than half of them were reopened almost immediately. Then in February of this year, the Egyptians started cracking down even harder. And instead of simply covering over the tunnels, they were using big stomping machines to collapse the tunnels, and also using saline waters. Some reports say it was sewage water, but they were using water with some sort with chemicals or from the ocean that had salt in it to erode the tunnel from the inside. And so in this manner, they were actually destroying, and effectively so, a lot more tunnels than they had previously. And they have stepped up that since February to now. And I think you probably saw this week, they say another 50 were destroyed. And another thing to think about the tunnels is actually that no one is really certain how many there are. So this complicates understanding the effectiveness of destroying them. I've read reports, Reuters will say that at the height of smuggling, there were 1,500 tunnels. That doesn't exactly make sense to me. That's basically a tunnel every 5 feet. But I don't know what that number was. The interesting thing to look at, though, is that as Israel and as Israel-Egypt have eased the blockade on Gaza since 2010, the tunnels themselves have stopped being used for many of the goods that they used to be used for. So it's no longer cost-effective to take many items through the tunnels. That isn't true, of course, for weapons, which can't get in any other way, and the same thing for fighters. So those are the important things that both Egypt and Israel are concerned of with the tunnels. Something that Egypt should also be concerned about is that one of the major commodities smuggled through tunnels is Egyptian fuel. Because even though the Israelis allow fuel to come in through the legal border crossing, subsidized Egyptian fuel is significantly cheaper. So smugglers will purchase Egyptian fuel either at an Egyptian gas station or on the black market for rock-bottom prices and then smuggle it to Gaza and be able to make a hefty profit because the price of gas in Egypt is significantly less than the price of it in Israel coming through the legal border.
That's a very good entrepreneurship plan they've got going over there.
Yeah, absolutely. Take someone else to and let them subsidize the fuel and then make the profit.
Exactly. Oh, we know that they're very ambitious, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. The other thing that, going back to the militant aspect in the Sinai, I've seen different reports that it's not just militant groups that are, let's say, becoming or breeding in the Sinai. It's not just residents of the Sinai. I mean, I've heard conflicting reports that there are actually people coming out of Afghanistan, a lot of different countries, and they're sort of coming into the Sinai and banding together. Why don't we discuss that slightly?
Sure, and that's something that is all, it's complicated. From a source that I spoke with, let's say it's difficult to confirm.
Right.
It seems that there was a point during which there were foreigners in the Sinai, and it's unclear if they were in the Sinai. This is sort of Al-Qaeda affiliates from Yemen or somehow affiliated in Yemen came to the Sinai, and it's unclear if they were there to train fighters in the Sinai or if they were passing through the Sinai on their way to Gaza. A journalist I spoke with, who's very familiar with the Sinai, said that there was only one source talking about foreign fighters, and then that one source refused to give confirmation. So he was a little skeptical. I know that I've seen that report. It was reported, I believe, in CNN, but I've certainly seen other reporters who are familiar with the Sinai say that there had been foreign fighters there. It's not clear now if there are any, and certainly if there are, they're not to an extent that we would think of as training camps in Pakistan or Afghanistan. There might be, you know, one or two here or there. And it's just not clear. The Egyptian military will deny that there is any sort of Al-Qaeda in the Sinai. This is actually it's interesting to me because you would think that they would want to play up the idea of an Al-Qaeda in the Sinai to sort of get U.S. support for cracking down. But I think they're also concerned, the Egyptian military is very concerned about this idea of sovereignty. And I think that they think that if the Americans believed there was Al-Qaeda in the Sinai, that America would start running drones and trying to take over some sort of a program. So in some ways, it's in their interest. In some ways, it's in their interest to blow up the threat. In other ways, it's in their interest to play down the threat.
Right. And then speaking of the threat. Yeah. Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say that there is the problem of Egyptians who are not Bedouin, who are not from the Sinai, coming to the Sinai and involving themselves in this Salafi jihadi business. And, you know, again, going back to whether there are or are not foreigners in the Sinai, I guess that depends what you consider a foreigner. There was one attack in, I believe it was the attack in 2011, where the group claimed that that was carried out by an Egyptian from the mainland and by a Saudi national. I don't know if that was ever proved. But one thing that you have to see is that because there are so few jobs in Egypt generally, that there are individuals in mainland Egypt, from the Nile Delta especially, who would come to Sinai to work in the smuggling trade, to work in smuggling or to work in the tunnels. And they may be there and decide that, first of all, their trade could be disrupted by these tunnels' destruction and they have nothing to do. Or they could simply be enamored with the Salafi jihadi groups that they come across while there and sort of get into a training of their own.
And so that's an interesting point, touching on the topic of mainland Egyptians coming to the Sinai and basically looking for a better solution to their economic woes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, since the Egyptian government, you know, it was Morsi, now it's, but as you said, it was very much the Egyptian army having their hand in it. Since they are cracking down a lot more on the tunnels, on the smuggling trades, and taking away what you could call an opportunity for certain Egyptians, could you potentially see this actually creating more animosity towards the Egyptian army, towards the Egyptian government, and a stronger backlash coming out of the Sinai due to this? You know, you're taking away, say, potentially desperately, your only someone might desperately think it's their only opportunity at a livelihood. Could you see that there's going to potentially could be a backlash because of this?
Well, I think, you know, I mentioned on Twitter the other day that I think that if the Egyptian military was smart, one of the first things it would do now that it's back in charge is implement all of the promised development plans that both Morsi and the military have been discussing over the past 2 years, saying that they were going to develop the Sinai, that they were going to give more economic opportunities for the population. And I think that there is a lot of opportunity to develop industries other than simply smuggling, and that the military needs to take advantage of doing so and not treating the Bedouin population as the Mubarak regime had treated it for the past 30 years.
They're almost, from, I guess, a very simple way of explaining it from my own research, they were almost looked at as second-class citizens and put on the back burner.
Yeah, and they also weren't necessarily trusted. Obviously, the Sinai had been under Israeli authority from 1967 to 1982. Two, I believe, was the final handover. And I could see where I don't agree with, but the Egyptian population, especially the Egyptian government, viewed them with a lot of distrust. You see, actually, one of the things to consider is that most of the instability in Sinai is taking place in North Sinai. South Sinai does have a Bedouin population, but it also has a tourist infrastructure. Now, that tourist infrastructure does not provide a lot of economic activity for the Bedouin population, but it does provide some. And so the South Sinai population sort of knows that by messing with tourism and with infrastructure, they hurt their own livelihood as drivers, and those sorts of somewhat menial jobs, but at least there's some jobs. You have seen in South Sinai a lot of kidnappings of tourists, and so that sort of goes against the idea that you need things to be safe. But at the same time, that's the Bedouin population sort of sees kidnapping as a method of getting attention from the state. And you've seen that, unlike in some places such as Yemen, the kidnappings are not done by Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda affiliates. They're done by Bedouins who are basically just trying to get attention from the state. And this is why we've seen, in the most cases, the victims of kidnapping treated well and then turned over rather soon, as opposed to seeing beheadings or anything like awful like that.
And to sort of wrap up the conversation regarding the Sinai and with the recent events in mainland Egypt, I mean, what do you see for that region of Egypt? Where do you see Sinai's future potentially going, even though most of Egypt's future right now is very uncertain? But say in this interim period of waiting for next presidential elections and seeing what's happening with that topic, what do you see Sinai's role in the next number of months?
I think, you know, jihadis are jihadis, and they don't need an excuse to attack the state or to attack Israel next door. That's what they have been doing. It's what they'll continue to do. The question is how the events of the past week and how the events over the next, let's say, 6 months of this transition phase will affect the general population of Egypt, and whether the Salafi jihadi discourse will come to be accepted by a larger population, sort of seeing that, yeah, they kind of do have a point.
And do you see potentially, if mainland Egypt continues to escalate into even more unrest than is happening at the moment, I mean, do you think there's a potential that the Egyptian army is going to pull out some of their troops from the Sinai because they're going to need them in the mainland? Or do you think that they're going to be, not to be rude, but smart enough to keep a good foothold in the Sinai?
Sure. They, first of all, the Egyptian army is a huge army. So in terms of troop strength, they would not need to pull out of Sinai the troops they have in order to secure more urban areas. That said, it's possible that they could take the eye off the ball, in the sense that they might have the strength to continue operations in Sinai, but they would consider other areas, especially the Suez region, Cairo, Alexandria, to be more concerning in terms of the security situation from a governing level. And so while they might have the troop strength to stay in Sinai, they might be focusing operations elsewhere. And that's certainly something to consider, and I think that it's something that will be considered across the border as well by Israel, and I'm sure that Israel will continue to request that Egypt keep its eye on the ball and perhaps plan for contingencies otherwise.
Interesting. Well, to wrap the conversation, we always like to give our guests sort of the podium to, I don't know, touch on a topic that maybe we haven't in the talk, or if there's a last statement you'd like to make. So we'd love to hear it.
Sure. No, I think I would just mention how the dynamics of Egypt and how quickly they change. As I mentioned, I believe, before the broadcast, I was in Cairo just a few weeks ago, and it was eerily quiet to the point that Tahrir Square was open for traffic, and that I, with Americans, could walk through Tahrir without being harassed. But the quiet wasn't kept, it didn't stop there from being a tension. And I think that's what it was, is that even though it had quieted down, the tense atmosphere that I had experienced when I was last in Egypt in February still existed. And we saw that that tension broke right before June 30th. And it will be interesting to see the ups and downs and the dynamics of Egypt in the coming weeks and months.
Very, very true. I say ditto on that one. Well, I thank you for coming on the show, Zach.
Thank you for having me.
And just for our listeners, Zach is an analyst who focuses on U.S. and Egyptian relations, as well as Egyptian Sinai and Israel's role in the Egyptian Sinai and policy with the Egyptian Sinai. So we will be posting some exciting papers that Zach has written on some of the topics that we've touched in this talk. So please look at those. And we thank you for having you on the show. And thank you for listening.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.